On quark matter, quantum chromodynamics, and quark stars. Any questions about last lecture? So we continue today with the study of QCD, what we know so far about QCD. And we start with looking at high temperatures. And the reason is that basically it's twofold. So we learned the concept of basically the limiting values of the equation of state of QCD at high temperatures. Similar methods we will apply for the high density equation of state of QCD. And second is that only at high temperatures you really have some reliable information on what the solution of the QCD Lagrangian is by solving on supercomputers the QCD Lagrangian and calculating the QCD equation of state. It's called lattice QCD calculations. Okay, so we start with a free quark matter at high temperatures. We have learned about the concept of asymptotic freedom the last time, meaning that if we go to very high energy scales, that asymptotically the coupling constant goes down, so the quarks behave as they are not interacting. So at asymptotic energies, they are free, asymptotic freedom of QCD. And the same thing should happen at high temperatures. If we go to asymptotically high temperatures, we can treat quarks as basically a quasi-free, as a free gas of quarks. And a similar concept we will apply for high densities if we go to very, very high chemical potentials, which we consider as the corresponding energy scale of our problem, then also QCD should be asymptotically free and the quarks should behave like in the free gas of quarks and gluons. Okay, gluons are important for high temperatures, but we will ignore them actually if we go to low temperatures. Okay, so let's look first at the pressure integral. As the starting point, the pressure integral is something which you are familiar with also from your astronomy and astrophysics lectures and from your lesson on thermodynamics. So the pressure is a function of temperature for free particles. So we consider free particles now. And for free particles, we know how the pressure goes as a function of temperature. So we have a degeneracy factor, which I denote as gamma, and then a phase space integral over k, the wave number, 2 pi cubed. And then there's some weight factor, k squared, over the energy of that particle, which depends on k, times the distribution function, and that distribution function depends only on the temperature. Yeah, it depends also on k. So if I want to, and the temperature. Okay. And the distribution function, yeah, so gamma is the degeneracy factor. Which will play a key role in determining the equation of state, actually. And then for the energy-momentum relation of free particles, we take the standard one, it's k squared plus m squared, where m is the mass of the particle, right? And the distribution function f of k and t is then given by 1 over the exponential e, which depends on k, over t minus 1, plus minus 1. Yep. Yeah. Where the plus sign is for fermions. and a minus sign is for bosons. Yeah, this is what you have learned in quantum statistics, just a repetition. So now we have actually a bunch of particles. Yeah, and we have particles with different masses. What we see from this expression is that if you have very massive particles, they will be suppressed by basically a factor 1 over m. Yeah, the pressure is suppressed by 1 over m. We have seen this actually already for the Fermi pressure, where we also have argued that electrons, the lightest particle, give the highest contribution to the pressure. The same is happening at high temperatures. Yeah? And the rule of thumb is that if the mass, if we look at a specific temperature scale, so if the mass of the particle is smaller than about 1/3 of the temperature, yeah, we can actually, we can use the relativistic limit. And vice versa, we can turn the argument around. If the mass is larger than the temperature divided by 3, then we have a non-relativistic particle, and that is suppressed by 1 over m. So basically, in considering the pressure of a gas or free particles, we take into account all known particles up to 1/3 of the temperature scale we have in mind. Yeah? Good. Let's see that in the back of your brain. So if you consider a free gas of particles, just consider the lightest particles up to 1/3 of the temperature scale. Okay? So let's look at the case m equals 0, basically. Yeah? Which basically implies that the mass is lower than T over 3. So the pressure as a function of temperature is then gamma over 2 pi cubed d3k, being more explicit here now. And then we have a function here, which is 1 over exponential of k over t plus minus 1, right? And the d3k, we assume now it's just a spherical integral. So this one we can replace actually with 4 pi dk times k squared. Did I miss something? Question? Oh, yes, we need a k squared. We need actually, there's a k squared over k, so there's a factor k missing. Right, thanks you. Thanks, so it's k over. Yep, thanks. So this means we can write the pressure as a function of temperature as gamma over 2 pi squared, a one-dimensional integral dk k cubed over e to k over t plus minus 1. And that integral is pi squared, can be solved analytically, over 90. Times the temperature to the fourth power. And we get a degeneracy factor of gamma for bosons. And the degeneracy factor 7/8 times gamma for fermions. That's just the solution of this integral, which is basically something like x cubed e to x plus minus 1. By making a proper substitution of the variables, yeah, and then one finds that it's this number pi squared over 90 coming from this factor. And of course, if you have bosons, we have a minus 1 here. So this integrand here down here is smaller. So we get a larger contribution compared to fermions. But it's just a small suppression, 7 over 8. Yeah. So this gives us a very simple expression for the Stefan-Boltzmann limit. That's called the Stefan-Boltzmann limit if you go to asymptotically large temperature. Then the pressure is a function of temperature in the Stefan-Boltzmann limit. Is given as pi squared over 90 temperature to the fourth power, and then the sum of the gamma I of the bosons plus 7 over 8 times the sum over the gamma I of fermions. Okay, questions so far? Good. Okay, so we have to count, that we know, so we only need to count number of degrees of freedom, then we have the equation of state. Yeah, question?
Are those factors gamma and 7 over 8 gamma supposed to be multiplied with pi squared over 90 t to the 4th, or how can I
Yes,
understand this?
Has to be multiplied. Oh, yeah, it's a multiplication factor, yeah. Thanks. Okay. Okay, so let's go to QCD. Let's count the degrees of freedom we have for QCD. So we have gluons and quarks. We need to count. So let's start with gluons. So the gluons, they have spin equal 1, so they are bosons. Spin 1/2 for the quarks, so these are fermions. Right, you're familiar with the spin statistic theorem. Yeah, if it's an integer number, it's bosons, it's half integer, then these are fermions. Okay, so let's count the number of gluons. The gluons have spin 1, so already here we have 2 degrees of freedom, like the photon. We have 2 polarization states. The mass is 0. But in addition, they carry color charge. So so the gluon is equal to 2 for the spin. And then we have number of colors squared minus 1 for the color degrees of freedom. And we did this counting before, yeah, that we have color anti-color as the gluon states, and we have SU3 symmetry, as we have the unitary group, the special unitary group, then we only have, instead of 3 times 3 combinations, we have 3 times 3 minus 1 combinations. Yeah, so this is this nc squared minus 1. So this is 2 times 8 gluons. So 16 degrees of freedom we have for the gluons. Now let's come to the quarks. For the quarks, they have spin 1/2. So we have spin up and spin down. This gives also a factor 2s plus 1. 2s, let's write it down, 2s plus 1. Let me write it down also here, 2s plus 1 here, which gives then, which actually is not correct because it's a massless particle. No, it's okay. So 2s plus 1 for quarks, because they are massive. And then we have, for particle, antiparticle, we have a factor 2. So this is antiparticle. This is spin. This one is also spin. This one is color. Then we also have color, which is NC. Okay. What am I missing? Yeah, the number of flavors. So number of flavors, so this is color. And this is flavor, which we discussed the last time. We have six different kinds of flavor. But now consider the rule of thumb we have here. M should be smaller than T over 3. Yeah, so NF depends on which temperature scale we're working at. So if we are above the mass of the top quark, this would be 6, which is well beyond 170 GeV. Okay, divided by 3, it's 60 GeV. Well beyond 60 GeV, we have 6 flavors. If we go up to the charm quark, we are talking about something like 400 MeV temperatures. And it turns actually out that the QCD phase transition we're interested in and is around 150 MeV. So we only take into account everything up to the strange quark, which has a mass of 100 MeV. So already above 30 MeV, we have basically a massless. We can consider the strange quark to be massless. So in the two cases, for the two flavors, we get 24 as the number and 36. This is for NF equal 2, and this is for NF equal 3. Yeah. Now the Stefan-Boltzmann limit is then given by pi squared over 90 temperature to the fourth power. Then we have 16 degrees of freedom for the gluons, and we have this number times 7 over 8. Yeah, so this gives actually, instead of 24, this gives actually 21. So it's 10.5 times NF effective degrees of freedom we have for the pressure. Yeah, these are the degrees of freedom, but these are basically the effective degrees of freedom for the pressure. And that gives pi squared 90 temperature to the 4 times 37 for NF equal 2 and 47.5 for NF equal 3. Yeah. And this is all valid for T larger than the strange quark divided by 3. Which is about 30 MeV. And I see that I just have made a mistake up there. T is the correct expression. Okay. So I was just stating it the other way around. So, okay. Now we can look at lattice state at high temperatures. Lattice QCD calculations. They see actually a phase transition at a temperature Tc, which is about 150 MeV, and that value is known within a few MeV. So what is going to happen is what they see on the lattice, what they usually plot is the pressure over temperature to the fourth power. So this is the pressure in relation to the Stefan-Boltzmann limit, sometimes just the pressure over T to the 4. Yeah, asymptotically we know this should reach 1. Yeah. Unless a new degree of freedom is opening, then it will jump up. And here we have the temperature in GeV. And one sees the following on the lattice. So we have 0.2, 0.4, 0.6. Basically, it goes up here. So, okay, so this is the lattice data. Or this is what is realized within the QCD Lagrangian. And now we can compare with models. And the simplest model we can do is that we can say, okay, we have a bag model, which we considered the last time. Now the bag model considers that we have a bag of quarks, which are confined within a certain volume. Yeah? And we can calculate the kinetic energy and treat them as free particles. Then we are basically back to this equation we have here. But in addition, we have the vacuum pressure. Yeah. So the MIT bag model would predict that actually we have a pressure which is 1/3 times the energy density minus 4 times the bag constant. And it makes also a prediction here for this high temperature behavior. So depending on the chosen value of the bag constant, which we can fix from the hadron spectrum, there is a big jump where it basically goes from values close to zero and goes up here. So this is the MIT bag model. This here is the Stefan Boltzmann limit. So actually it fails in describing the lattice data. So here we see that we cannot extend the MIT bag model to this case. It works for the hadron spectrum, but it doesn't really describe the lattice data. And even if you shift the bag constant, you always will have the same behavior. There's a too rapid rise with temperature of the pressure, so it cannot really fit the data. What fits the data is actually perturbative QCD. So perturbative QCD says, okay, let's start with asymptotically free quarks and lower the temperature, and then add as a perturbation that there are some interactions between the quarks mediated by gluons at first order. Then if you go lower and lower temperatures, that's at the higher order, second order, third order, more complicated diagram. So you can do a perturbative expansion coming from high temperatures down. Yeah. And what you find is that actually in perturbative QCD, you have some predictive power here, where you can vary a certain scale, the renormalization subtraction scale we were discussing the last time, this lambda, within certain bounds. And you can vary this up at this very high temperatures and you see the error is quite small. But the lower you go in temperatures, the higher orders you have to take into account and the more sensitive you are to these higher orders. And the more sensitive you are to this renormalization subtraction scale. So what you find is that this band actually gets broader and broader and broader and eventually is so broad that it really here cannot make any prediction anymore. And usually it describes the data fairly well, so this is perturbative QCD. QCD calculation. Luckily, there's always some color around. So this is the data, and this is perturbative QCD. Ah, there's some gluon, yes. There's some gluon. Okay. Any questions about this? Have you seen this before or are familiar with? No. Okay. Yeah. So this is why we can have some trust that perturbative QCD works in describing at least the high temperature behavior. And note that we have a small offset here, so I'm not a particular good painter. This doesn't go down really, it always doesn't go down with higher temperatures. It always goes up with higher temperatures. But there's still some offset even at those temperatures from the interactions. So this alpha S interactions make a substantial change to the equation of state. Note that the alpha S is at the level of 0.1 to 0.3. Yeah, so it's maybe 1/10 or 1/3. And that's, of course, quite large compared to the electromagnetic one. The alpha electromagnetic, the fine structure constant is 1 over 137. This is 10 to minus 2. Much, much smaller. Yeah. So here, even at these high temperatures, well above TC, we still have residual interactions between quarks, which is taken care of with perturbative QCD. Yeah, so this perturbative QCD is basically we have quarks interacting by gluons. Okay. Good. Yeah. So the idea that we start with quasi-free particles and then add some corrections to it from perturbative QCD is the concept we put over now to describe quark matter. Yeah, so we have some motivation that we can really describe quark matter in terms of some free gas of quarks plus interactions we add on top of it. Yeah, so that's the idea. So let's do this. At zero temperature, now we go to zero temperatures. Unfortunately, at present we cannot solve QCD on supercomputers at high chemical potentials or even non-zero chemical potentials. There's a sign problem during the lattice QCD calculations which prevents any firm calculation. What they are doing is that they can do some Taylor expansion or some extrapolation what's going on at non-zero mu. There are other methods which are work at very, very high quark masses, but so far we cannot solve QCD with physical quark masses in the density range we want to have it to know the quark equation of state as much as we know the quark equation of state at high temperatures. Okay. 8.2, free strange quark matter. So as the name says, we consider up, down as strange quarks. It turns actually out that the charm quark also does not play a role for neutron stars. We considered this actually. We looked at the baryon chemical potential and the appearance of new particles and saw that basically charmed hadrons do not appear. They are too heavy. And the same applies also for the charm quark actually. Yeah, the charm quark is too heavy to appear neutron star matter. So first we have the chemical potential of the quarks. In general, the chemical potential of a particle is equal to the baryon number of the particle times the baryon chemical potential plus the charge of the particle times the charge chemical potential. Yeah, and here I have a different notation. Because later on I want to introduce the quark chemical potential, so I switch from Q to Z. So B is the baryon number. Yeah, the Baron number of quarks is, of course, 1/3. Yeah, if we go to t equals 0, we only take into account quarks, so we have a plus 1/3. For anti-quarks, we would have minus 1/3. Set I is the charge. Yeah, and the charge of quarks is either plus 2/3 or is minus 1/3. We have seen, yeah, for the up quark it's plus 2/3, for the down quark and the strange quark it's minus 1/3. Yeah. So we can write down the chemical potentials of the up and down quarks. So mu up is equal 1/3 mu b plus 2/3 times mu z. And in terms of the electron chemical potential, it's 1/3 mu b minus 2/3 times the 1 of the electron. Yeah, the electron has charge minus 1. So the mu down is then 1/3 mu b plus 1/3 mu e. And actually, beta equilibrium, we don't have any strangeness conserved, so this is equal to actually the one of the strange quark mu s. Yeah? Has the same quantum numbers. Baryon number is 1/3, the charge is minus 1/3. Yeah? Good. So this is one case. The other case is that in addition, we also have the following weak equilibrium relation between electrons and quarks. So we have weak equilibrium, which says that when we have an up quark plus an electron, this goes over to a down quark plus a neutrino, which escapes the system at zero temperature. Now basically, we only need to consider this reaction here and do not take care of the neutrino, which is just going out of the system. This number is not conserved for neutron stars, for cold neutron stars. So we have a relation between the chemical potentials in chemical equilibrium. Just recall the lecture we had on this. Yeah, so this is mu of the up quark plus mu of the electron is equal mu of the down quark. Yeah. And in addition, we have that mu s is mu d. So this is these are the two confining equations for a weak equilibrium for quark matter. And basically that these relations hold is ensured by the way we set it up above there. So you can convince yourself, if you put in the expressions we have above, then these relations are of course fulfilled by construction. So now we can calculate the pressure. We say it's a free gas of quarks, free gas of massless quarks. So for massless quarks, basically it means that the chemical potentials we consider here are, the scale is much larger, and the quark, yeah, the chemical potentials we consider is much, much larger than the mass of the quarks. The chemical potential of the quarks is much larger than m quark. And we define a quark chemical potential where we say mu quark is defined as 1/3 times the Baryon chemical potential. Yeah, so far this is the definition. And it relates now to the quark number, basically. Yeah, it's related to the quark number. Not really the quark number. Yeah, it is related to the quark number. If there's no other chemical potential around. So the pressure we can calculate is the pressure of an ultra-relativistic gas of particles. So this is 1 over 4 pi squared. We did these calculations before. This is the ultra-relativistic limit. So it's sum over I mu I to the 4th power. Yeah, we derived this before. And the number density n, ni, is just given by the partial derivative of the pressure with the respective chemical potential. And the energy density is given by the Euler relation minus the pressure plus the sum of mu I times ni. Good. Yeah, just reconsider this integral we have. So the pressure of each individual particle, Pi, is gamma over 3 E3k over 2 pi cubed. K is equal to gamma over 6 pi squared dk times k cubed from 0 to the Fermi momentum of the particle, which is gamma over 24 pi squared times the Fermi momentum of the particle to the 4th power. Yeah, and I is now up, down, and strange quark. So we can calculate the pressure of all quarks. The pressure of all quarks is then the one of the up quarks, the one of the down quarks, the one of the strange quarks. And this is then given by 1 over 4 pi squared mu up to the 4th power, mu down to the 4th power, plus mu strange to the 4th power. Yeah. But assuming for the master's case, of course, this just corresponds to mu I, this Fermi momentum here for master's particles, which we have also written down here. Good. What is the number density? Number density ni is gamma over 6 pi squared the Fermi momentum to the 3rd power, or 1 over pi squared the chemical potential to the 3rd power. We implemented now the gamma factor for individual quarks, which is 6. Yeah, 2 for the spin, 3 for the color. Gamma I. So gamma I is equal 6 for the quarks. So if you plug in these relations, what you find is then, of course, we recover the equation of state for a free gas of particles, which is the energy density is equal, or the pressure is equal. Let's write this one. As a function of energy density for a free gas of particles, free gas of massless particles.
One third.
Times?
Energy density?
Yes. So after all these calculations and all these integrals, you find actually that equation of state is really that one of a free gas of particles, as it should be. Good. So let's continue talking about quark matter, and so far we have considered just the number density of up, down, and strange quarks, but in addition we have to take into account for neutron star matter or quark stars, charge neutrality. Yeah, so we have a total charge, which is the sum over the individual charges of the quarks times the number density of quarks. So this is 2/3 times the number density of up quarks, minus 1/3 times the number density of down quarks, minus 1/3 the number density of strange quarks. So now we realize that there's actually a trivial solution. And that is actually if you just put all the number densities to be equal. Yeah. So if you just say the number density of up quarks is the one of down quarks, is the one of strange quarks, then it follows automatically that the total charge is zero. This comes from the fact that 2/3 minus 1/3 minus 1/3 just balance each other nicely to total charge zero. Yeah. This would also imply that the number density of any other charged particle, the electron as well as the muon, must be zero. Yeah. So in the case at very high densities for free strange quark matter, basically we have no electrons in the system. Yeah, that's in contrast to neutron star matter, where we always have an admixture of protons and electrons. Yeah. This also means actually this is proportional to the Fermi momenta, to the chemical potential, that basically the chemical potentials of all quarks are the same, and they are just given by the quark chemical potential, yeah? Because the electron chemical potential is zero from this here. Come on. So we can compute now the baryon number density in this case. N capital B is given by 1 over pi squared mu q to the 3rd power is, yeah, we have 3 quark species, and there's a factor 1/3 coming from converting baryon number to quark number. So we just, this cancels out, so it's 1 over pi squared mu cubed. And this is 0.36 Fermi to minus 3 for a quark chemical potential of 300 MeV to the power 3. Yeah, why 300 MeV? 300 MeV, if you can look at the baryon chemical potential, the typical one we have in neutron stars, it starts at 1 GeV, at a nucleon mass. So quark star matter should then also start around 1/3 this value, which is 300 MeV. So this is 0.36 Fermi to minus 3. How much is this in relation to the saturation density of nuclear matter? Is this a lot, or is this dilute compared to nuclear matter, neutron star matter?
It's like twice.
It's about twice. Yeah. So it's not that far off, actually, from nuclear matter. And the energy density, we can compute this one also. This is 3 times the pressure. And this turns out to be 9 over 4 pi squared, mu q to the 4th power. Yeah, we get a factor 3 here, and we get a factor 3 from counting all quarks, so this gives the factor 9 instead of just 1 over 4 pi squared, and this is 240 MeV Fermi to minus 3 and the scales with the quark chemical potential to the fourth power. And how much is this one in comparison to the energy density we have for nuclear matter? What's the energy density of nuclear matter? Epsilon naught. Do you recall? Okay, 140 MeV per Fermi cubed. The nucleon mass times 0.15 Fermi to minus 3. So this is the energy density we have inside nucleons, or inside nuclei, and at saturation density. Yeah, and this is the typical energy density we have for quark matter. So it's a little bit less than twice the energy density which we know from nuclear matter. Okay, so we can make actually a table where we put mu q. Yeah, maybe I leave this as an exercise. And then you can calculate as a function of mu q, you can leave as an exercise, you can calculate the energy densities and the baryon number densities. It turns out that mu q from 300 to 500 MeV is sufficient to really discuss the properties of quark stars. Yeah. If you just double mu quark to say 600 MeV, this is then 2 cubed, this is 8 times, so this is 16 times saturation then number density. And here it even goes with the fourth power even higher. Yeah, this is a factor 16 times nearly 2. So we are 30 times saturation energy density. This is hardly reached inside a quark star. Yeah. The important thing, of course, for the equation of state is not the number density, but the energy density. This is what is the input in the Toff equation. It's an important one. Yeah. So comparison, typical epsilon or typical rho bar, we can estimate as being 3m over 4 pi r cubed, which we have in any compact star, is 270 MeV per Fermi cubed for a 2 solar mass pulsar with a radius of 10 kilometers. Oops, 10 kilometers over r cubed. So the typical average mass density or energy density is 270 MeV per Fermi cubed. So this is about twice saturation energy density. Yeah, that's the scale we have for any compact object with that mass and that radius, irrespective of what the composition is actually, right? So, and now we need to consider the effect of non-zero quark masses. And this will be an exercise. But the final outcome is that there are small corrections from the strange quark. Zero, as the strange quark mass is much smaller than the typical quark chemical potential, a factor 3 again, so we can really see, you can calculate yourself. There are small corrections for the electron chemical potential, and for the electron density is rather small. Okay, exercise. Good. Any questions about? Now, this is just free gas of quarks. Any questions? Good. Then we do some Then we construct a star out of this stuff. And we have to talk about self-bound stars. So who knows what a self-bound star is?
I think it was a star that normally we have a star because we have a gravitational force that goes against a radiation pressure, but for a self-bound star we don't need something like that because it's bound by itself, so it doesn't work against a force if it doesn't have an external force.
Mm-hmm. So it's bound by itself, right? Anything else? For which kind of equations of state do we get a self-bound star? Bound by itself means that the pressure at the surface vanishes. So normally for neutron stars we have an outgoing pressure and we have an inward pull of gravity. Now we're saying, okay, that stuff is bound by itself, we don't need gravity, so the pressure at the surface must be zero. But still, the matter is at non-zero energy density. So from this argument we immediately see what we need to have in order to have self-bound stars. We need to have a non-vanishing pressure. A vanishing pressure at a non-vanishing energy density. Pressure must have vanished. So the pressure at some value which we call, it must be the vacuum one, yeah? So the pressure at a vacuum, energy density is zero. Where epsilon is not zero, where epsilon vacuum is larger than zero, not equal zero. Okay. And that is the confining equation of state, or the confining property of the equation of state in order to have a self-bound star. Thinking in terms that we have a Toff equation and an equation of state as input. Of course, you can think about other configurations which are stabilized by some quantum fields, yes, like solitons or some classical fields which have solitonic structures which make the whole thing self-bound. This could also be a possibility. So I'm just talking and thinking about a Toff equation with an equation of state. Then what is the property of the equation of state? The property must be that the pressure vanishes at a non-zero value of the energy density. So this means if we plot the pressure versus the energy density, here we have the vacuum energy density, and then the pressure basically starts from here. Yeah. And it can start anywhere, so it doesn't matter. So the only thing is that the pressure vanishes here. So in comparison, neutron stars, the pressure vanishes when the energy density vanishes. So it always starts here and goes up like this, yeah, for comparison. Yeah. Okay, now a ring should bell in the back of your head, right? Self-bound stars, we have a vacuum energy density. QCD with a non-trivial quark and gluon condensates, the MIT Bragg model, right? So, yeah. So QCD, we have a pressure. So far we discussed the pressure of quarks. We omitted gluons. There are no non-zero gluons, and at there are no gluons at zero temperature. Why are there no gluons at zero temperature in the free gas of particles? Pardon me?
Because gluons don't have antiparticles.
Gluons do not have antiparticles. They are their own antiparticles.
Ah.
Yeah, so.
And it's more.
Maybe gluons always have an inward pressure.
Gluons always have an inward pressure? No, it's more trivial. Just from a free gas of particles, yeah.
They always come in pairs.
They all come in pairs? Yeah. So why do we set the pressure at T equals zero for gluons zero? We didn't even discuss it. But maybe we should discuss it. Okay, another question is we can take other bosons, photons. So why didn't we consider photons at T equals zero for the neutron star? Where there are photons around for T equals zero, aren't there? So
because they have a chemical potential of zero.
They have a chemical potential of zero, right. So they will have no photons around, the chemical potential is zero. And also for gluons, we don't have any conservation of number. So in principle, you can always say, okay, I have massless bosons, and massless bosons, the pressure goes like T to the fourth power, and if the temperature is zero, the bosons do not appear. But if we have a chemical potential for bosons, then bosons would also appear. So this is then Bose condensation. But gluons do not have a chemical potential, so we don't have gluons appear at T equals zero. Okay, so we have the pressure of quarks, then no gluons, and then we have a contribution from the vacuum, which is given by minus the energy density of vacuum, as we discussed, yeah, from thermodynamic consistency. So now the energy density is the energy density of quarks plus the energy density of the vacuum. Yeah. And this is 3 times the pressure of quarks. Yeah, just from the relation we have for massless particles plus the energy density of the vacuum. So now we can put in for p quark, we can put in p minus epsilon vacuum in here. So we get actually it's p plus epsilon vacuum. So this gives a 3 plus 1. This gives a factor 4 for the vacuum energy density. So this gives a 1/3 times epsilon minus epsilon vacuum. Minus epsilon vacuum for the pressure, and this is a 1/3 times the energy density minus 4 times the energy density of the vacuum. Yeah, so this is the MIT Bag equation of state we discussed before. So an MIT Bag model one associates this vacuum energy density with the Bag constant. I should write down now Bag constant so that it's not confusing relating it to the baryon number. So B is the Bag constant and that's the vacuum energy density. Yeah. Okay. We discussed scaling relations for this type of equations of state. This should be the pressure actually. For these types of equation of state, we discussed the energy momentum relation, right? We have seen it goes like R cubed. And we have seen the maximum mass, right? So this goes like M versus R. So this goes like this and reaches the maximum mass. And here it is actually proportional to R cubed, which means actually that M over R cubed is a constant, approximately. This we found from the scaling relations from the Toff equation. And it basically states that this constant mass density, of course, is just the vacuum energy density we put in here. Right? This is the typical energy density which appears here. And therefore, the whole thing goes just up like a fluid, which has the same density, and then you just increase the volume, and correspondingly, the mass goes like R cubed, proportional to the volume. So this, and one thing is, of course, we can have arbitrarily small masses, arbitrarily small masses are possible. It goes to zero here, basically. This is different to neutron star equation of state. Does anybody recall the minimum mass for neutron stars? No, not one solar mass, no. Yeah.
The middle mass from the core, from the star as a whole.
Pardon me? 0.1, right. So if we look at neutron stars, we have a minimum mass. Yeah, for neutron stars, for comparison. One solar masses. Yeah, so if you look at neutron stars, they actually go like this. They have a maximum mass also. And then reach a minimum mass at the radius of about 200 kilometers. So this is a neutron star here. Where we have in between, so M goes proportional to 1 over r cubed, and then r is about constant from interactions. These are the typical regions, mass-radius relations for a neutron star. Right?
But are there any mechanism to produce a object like that?
To produce a quark star?
No, a neutron star with 0.1.
Oh. You want to produce a neutron star with 0.1 solar masses. Yeah. Will be not so easy. Yeah. So from stellar evolution, right, we have to start with at least 8 solar masses, and we have a core which has more than 1 solar mass. So if you look at modern supernova simulations, the minimum amount or the minimum mass producible in a supernova explosion is about 1 solar mass. So from stellar evolution theory, from the modern simulations we have at hand now, you cannot produce a neutron star by a core collapse supernova below 1 solar mass. So that this must be produced by another mechanism. Like, for example, you have some clash of a neutron star with a black hole, and the neutron star is stripped of most of its mass, but not all of it. So maybe 0.1 solar mass survives and manages to escape the pull of gravity of the black hole, and then one could have maybe such a neutron star. That would be spectacular, actually. Yeah.
If it was just below this limit, like if we say the neutron star gets ripped apart and it's just below this limit, what would happen then?
Yeah, so the question was, what would happen if you produce now some chunk of a neutron star matter which has 0.09 solar mass or 0.08 solar mass below that limit? What would happen? Your suggestion? There are two options. In principle.
Yes.
Yeah, so it collapses to a black hole, or it expands and becomes a white dwarf.
White dwarf.
Yes. As I recall, that basically neutron stars with that masses are mainly composed out of a lattice of nuclei, like we have for a white dwarf. But most likely it will collapse to a black hole. Does that that way is shorter, right? We start at 200 kilometers to a few kilometers.
It's a small little black hole.
Then we have a tiny, tiny black hole, yeah, with 0.09 mass, solar masses. So we can solve the Toff equation with that equation of state, right? When we recovered actually the scaling relations solution. Of the Toff equation. Just to recall that we had these scaling solutions that the maximum mass M max was about 2 solar masses for a back constant of 145 MeV. And it scales actually like the square root of this relation. Yeah. We discussed back constants before, and we were, from the MIT back model, we had values between 145 MeV and 235 MeV. Yeah, if you put in now a larger number of the back constant, you will get actually masses below 2 solar masses. So we are actually here at the limit already within the MIT back model, if you consider this correct. And good. The problem is that now we have a new mass measurement. From last year, and that's the pulsating source of radiation, J0740 plus 6620, where the mass is 2.17 solar masses plus 0.11 minus 0.10 solar masses. Yeah. So within 1 sigma, actually, we are at 2.07 as the limiting value, and here we just get 2. So we are getting into trouble. The trouble can be made more pronounced by looking at stability analysis. Okay, so stability analysis. Stability of quark matter. Yeah, let me just denote that these values here are in danger. So stability of quark matter. So if you look at neutron stars, they consist out of quarks actually also. The quarks are inside neutrons. Here we have freely roaming quarks. So a quark star basically looks like we have the quarks floating around a quark star. For a neutron star, you have something where you have three quarks, schematically. Yeah, this is the very naive picture. Of course, this is a quantum field theory. This is quantum mechanics, right? So this is a geometric picture, just to elucidate the fact that here we have quarks which are confined, so they only can propagate within a certain radius freely, and here we have freely quarks, asymptotically free quarks. Yeah. But of course, the picture is very simplified. Yeah. And also, if you want to define the transition from this state to this state, in principle, you need to have an order parameter which tells you, okay, I'm in this state or I'm in this state. This would be the gluon condensate, which controls confinement, right? But there are no gluons around. That's one problem. The other problem is that The order parameter usually considered for confinement on the lattice does not work for high densities. This is the Polyakov loop. If you hear about this, the Polyakov loop is considered to be okay. This tells me this is a measure of whether I'm in a confined phase or deconfined phase, whether I have free quarks or quarks which are confined somewhere. This doesn't work here. This order parameter is not a well-defined order parameter, actually. So defining deconfinement at high densities basically doesn't really work. That's a problem. What one can do is use this other concept associated with the quark condensate, chirosymmetry. So we can actually say we have a chirosymmetry restoration from one state to the other and use this as an order parameter. But then this picture doesn't apply anymore. Chirosymmetry is something about quarks and left-handed and right-handed quarks. It's not a picture that really quarks are confined or not confined. Yeah. So we can have a phase transition, and we can still be in a phase which we might consider in some approximate limit as being confined. So, yeah, just to be cautious. So this is the naive picture of a quark star and a neutron star. However, it somehow is then troubling that this is based on the same Lagrangian, and now we have two different states which have basically the same mass and the same radius, or could have the same mass and the same radius according to our naive models. So how do we distinguish between those two? So one way is to say, okay, these are two separate solutions and two separate states, and there's a barrier in between. And this is called the Bodmer-Witten hypothesis. Bodmer-Witten hypothesis basically, there is exotic matter or absolutely stable. Quark matter. Coexists with normal matter. And that goes back to two seminal papers. Actually, Arnold Bodmer was the first one who considered this in 1971 already. And by the way, Arnold Bodmer was born in Frankfurt, and he was then a professor at Argonne National Lab. Edward Witten, then in the 80s, wrote a seminal paper, which actually was about the QCD phase transition in the early universe. But by discussing that, he also argued that during that cosmological QCD phase transition, at a temperature of 150 MeV, as we know, quark bubbles form, which are stable and survive this phase transition. Yeah. And by that, he proposed that maybe this quark plops are more stable than ordinary nuclei or ordinary nuclear matter, and survive until today. So this means that these quark stars could coexist with neutron stars, and there's a barrier in between. That's the hypothesis. So how does this work? So what is this barrier which prevents collapsing quarks to neutrons or neutrons to quarks? And for that, we need to consider now different flavors. That's the key point here. We have to consider that we have a strange quark in quark matter, usually. But we can also look at normal matter. So let's look at two-flavor quark matter. So the first condition is that if we have the bulk energy per mass number A for two-flavor should be larger than the mass of the nucleon minus the binding energy per particle of iron 56. Yeah. This is the two-flavor condition. So basically it means that we have nuclei which have basically that energy, right? This is the highest binding, this is the most stable nucleus we can have. Yeah. So this condition must be fulfilled. If this is not fulfilled, then nuclei can immediately collapse to up-down and quark matter. Yeah. There's nothing which prevents them. Yeah. You just have the same amount of up and down quarks here as you can have here, and then you just have a quark blob. No, so this must be fulfilled. There are corrections, so this binding energy actually takes into account also surface energy effects and Coulomb effects for the nucleus. So this needs to be taken into account also on this side here. And we don't know how large this effect is, so you make a rough guess. And the rough guess is that you assume, okay, first assume there's some surface contribution for NF equal 2. And the rough guess is that this is about 4 MeV, a small number. Very much similar to values we find for nuclei, actually. That's a small effect. 4 MeV, actually for nuclei, in nuclear matter, it's about 8. Inclusive Coulomb, it's about 8 MeV, yeah? So this is a few MeV correction. So this is the two-flavor constraint. And then we have the three-flavor constraint. So if you look at the bulk energy per baryon number for NF equals 3, then this is now smaller than the mass of the nucleon minus the binding energy of iron 56. Yeah. And this we consider in bulk. So we don't take into account any surface effects. This we consider in bulk. So we have to compute now the two-flavor and the three-flavor binding energy of strange quark matter and up-down quark matter, and see for which back constants we can fulfill these two constraints simultaneously. And then we have the window of opportunity where we can say, okay, in this window we can have absolutely stable strange quark matter coexisting with normal neutron matter. So this would be more stable than this one. Yeah. And this one here, nuclei, would be more stable than up-down quark matter. But up-down strange quark matter would be more stable than nuclei. Yeah, summarize. So up plus down plus strange quark matter more stable than nuclei. In bulk. Yeah. In bulk would be important, of course, if you consider neutron stars. Yeah? If you consider a star, a neutron star, which consists out of protons and neutrons, or iron nuclei converting to up-down strange quark matter, then we don't need to consider actually really surface terms. But why does this process is not happening? So now we have up-down strange quark matter, which is more stable than nuclei. In principle, now the nuclei could decay to up-down and strange quark matter. But why is this an option that this is not the case? And why do people consider the case of absolutely stable strange quark matter and nuclei, and we, and the table, and whatever you have, your smartphone is not collapsing to up-down strange quark matter, which prevents that decay?
Strange number is conserved?
Yes, strangeness number conservation. So we need simultaneously you need to have not only one, but n times violation of strangeness numbers. So this is a multiple weak decay, which is not happening on our usual surroundings. Yeah? So nuclei itself cannot decay in the lifetime of the universe to up down a strange quark matter plops. But what about neutron stars? So for neutron stars, the story is different, because there we have weak equilibrium and strangeness is not conserved. So people consider different scenarios, that you form a neutron star without any strangeness, and then from somewhere there comes a small strange quark matter blob, maybe from the early universe, from some quark star collision, or from some quark star encounter with a black hole where quark matter was stripped off. So there's a small junk of stuff, of up down strange quark matter blob, which hits a neutron star, and because of this stability it starts to convert nuclei to strange quark matter. So an ordinary neutron star by a seed could convert to a quark star.
Does that also happen to other objects or just to neutron stars?
Okay. This happens just to neutron stars. The reason is that there is no Coulomb barrier left anymore inside neutron stars. Mm. We always have this Coulomb barrier, so we don't have bulk matter. So there's always one nucleus and another nucleus. So you can convert maybe one nucleus, but not a whole bulk. It will be difficult. Yeah. You need some free neutrons around, which freely roam around, and they are eaten up by the quark blob. Yeah. Actually, this was a big discussion for the heavy ion collision machines at RIC and at the LHC. So there was a committee discussing these topics. Okay, what is happening if we produce absolutely stable strange quark matter within a collision? Then would this convert the Earth or so? And they really did calculations to ruling out this scenario to a very high degree. So, and we're still around. So LHC and RIC is running and still nothing happened. And one key argument was actually the moon. So the moon, because the moon is hit by highly energetic particles. So you could convert with highly energetic particles, the same particles you have in colliders, you could convert then the moon into a strange moon. But this has not happened for the last 4.5 billion years, so we could rule this out on this hand. Okay.
And in addition, like the one or two particles we would create, mm-hmm. I think, would they even be able to convert the Earth?
No, actually, if those quark matter blobs are too small, they will evaporate. They're not stable. So you need some minimum mass number for a stable quark.
It's like with before the LHC went online, there was also like this fear in the press that they would create a black hole and suddenly...
Yeah, there was
the same principle.
Yeah, the same holds for producing mini black holes. Yeah, they are also unstable. They would evaporate before they even hit any wall or any detector. Okay. So... I will just give you the results. So what comes out is so for NF equal 2, we will do this as an exercise. One finds that the pressure, that the bulk energy per mass number for NF equal 2 is given by 1 plus 2 to the power of 4/3 cubed 4 pi squared times the Bragg constant to the power of 1/4. And this must be larger than 934 MeV from the two flavor constraint. It's 930 from the binding energy of the nucleus plus 4 for the surface term. It's 934 MeV. And for NF equal 3, one calculates that the bulk energy per mass number is equal 3 cubed times 4 pi squared times the Bragg constant to the power of 1/4, and this must be smaller than 930 MeV. Yeah, we only have a small window here, 4 MeV, but we have different prefactors here. So this actually works out for certain back parameters. So from the first condition, here we get actually that the back constant must be.
If it has to be darker than 9.5 MeV, but smaller than 9.30.
We have different prefactors here. We have a 3 cubed compared to 1 plus 2.
The greater and smaller signs. This has to be inside a range. This currently just excludes a range of the 4 MeV between both numbers.
So this is the two flavor constraint. So up-down quark matter must be less stable than nuclei. This is the three flavor constraint. Up-down and strange quark matter shall be more stable than nuclei. And this is the Bodmer-Witten hypothesis. The answer, so we demand, okay, we want to have absolutely stable strange quark matter. But of course, this is a very simple model, and we know it doesn't describe actually lattice QCD. So this is basically a theoretician's toy model. It's not a theory of QCD, right? So it's a toy model. And within this toy model, we're looking for these kind of solutions. And this is for the two flavor. And the three flavor, actually, this constraint here gives that the back constant shall be smaller than 63 MeV. So if the back constant is between 145 and 163 MeV, we find absolutely stable strange quark matter, which fulfills also the two-flavor constraint. Yeah. Good. Yeah. And this is... So this is the lowest value for the back constant we can have, actually, for fulfilling the two-flavor constraint. Amusingly, it's the same number we have for fitting the hadron spectrum. And if we look at this relation, it's also the same value which just gives us two solar masses. But if we have this mass measurement, then actually the back constant should be smaller than 145 MeV, slightly smaller, in violation of the two-flavor constraint. So there's a tension here already at this level. Okay, so it tells you it is a simple model. Anyway, so any questions about absolutely stable and stable quark matter and quark stars? We will talk about interacting quark matter and the mass radius relation for quark stars then on Thursday, and we'll be able to close that chapter. Okay, then see you on Thursday.